Hi, this is Mark Cuniberti. You're about to listen to another edition of our award-winning economics show entitled Money Matters. The information given on this show is obtained from a variety of public sources and is deemed accurate at time of airing but is not guaranteed. This show is pre-recorded at an earlier date, so market indices and related stock market references may not be accurate at time of airing, and we will not be taking any listener call-ins. Thanks again for listening. Now enjoy the show.
And welcome to the 238th edition of Money Matters. My name is Mark Cuniberti. Thanks for joining me today. Today's show is entitled Halloween Market Expectations. Before we begin, please advise that discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I'm an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. The views expressed are my opinions only and the opinions of the authors I may quote. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, this station, its staff, members, or underwriters. The show is about money. As money is matter, and matters of money affect us all in some way or another, whether you have a lot of it, a little of it, or none of it. It controls our economy, our country, our planet, and in some way or another controls the very way we live our lives. It's about your money or lack of it or abundance of it. It's about our lives and livelihood. In short, Money Matters is about you. Well, how is everybody today? Dow floating around 18,267. What was that off a high of 18,006 something, somewhere around there? So it's still bouncing around the 18,000 level, and that is a support level. 18,000 is a support level by thumb theorists. These large numbers of 17,000, 18,000, 16,000, those can either be resistance levels on the way up. In other words, if we're into 17,000s, 18,000 would be a resistance. If we're above 18,000, then 18,000 would be a support level. So that's a key level for sure, so we'll keep an eye on that. Gold, meanwhile, has hit the expected correction, and it was down, 50-something bucks a couple days back. So it has finally started to correct, and didn't take me by too much of a surprise. How far it will go, no one knows, but it is down again today. Not much. Crude oil sitting around $51 a barrel. NASDAQ at 5308, Dow at 18267. And so, yeah, you're listening to Money Matters. My name's Mark. On here since 2005. Wow. Close to 1,000 newscasts or more, 238 shows, you name it. Carried here or there, about 40 stations all over the United States. Pick it up from time to time. So we're glad about that. It's time again I reach out to the community for our Turkey Matters food drive for the food banks of our counties. Well, how does Turkey Matters work? Well, I've been doing this for, 30 years in Marin and then up here. And so I'm asking you now, listeners, help me feed the poor with our annual turkey drive called Turkey Matters, where we, you, and I buy turkeys for the poor for Thanksgiving. The program is easy. Just make a checkout to the food bank of your choice. Don't make the checkout to me or this station. Make it out to the food bank of your choice. And you mail it to this station. This is the originating station of Money Matters. Our address is 120 Bridge Street, Nevada City, California, 95959. I will match a portion of your funds with my own money to that food bank, whatever food bank you choose. And this station will forward my check and yours to that food bank. So that's all there is to it, ladies and gentlemen. Turkey Matters is now in full gobble gear, so start your envelopes, please. So there you go. Yeah, years ago I was driving around Richmond, and I drove by the Richmond Rescue Mission, and here was this hand-painted wooden sign out there, said Richmond Rescue Mission, and then a bunch of indigent people hanging outside, and I said, there's a place that needs money. So I started sending them donations, and then that was happening every year around Thanksgiving, and then I switched to a food bank on 3rd Street in Santa Fe, would buy 400 or 500 turkeys for them, and then moved up here. And with the advent of radio, now I can ask you to help, and then your money goes that much farther. So there you go. So we'll keep an eye on the Dow today and cover some of the economic news so you can see what's happening. And of course, last week's long-awaited meeting of the Federal Reserve yielded what the majority of economists expected. No increase in the federal funds rate yet again. Did you know the last increase, in fact the only increase since 2006, took place in December of 2015? That may have sparked the massive sell-off in equity markets in 2016 that we saw in January. May. Many theorize that with the upcoming election, whoa, that'd be heavy, huh? The Fed would not increase rates during the week, last week, so as to possibly not spark a market sell-off right before the election. Fed Chief Janet Yellen is a Democrat. And although politics are not supposed to play a part in monetary policy from the Federal Reserve, one could draw another conclusion. No matter what the conspiracy buffs may think about the Fed's playing political football, the Fed's statement allayed that suspicion by saying, quote, near-term risks to the economic outlook appear roughly balanced. The committee judges that the case for an increase in the federal funds rate has strengthened, but decided, for the time being, to wait for further evidence of continued progress towards its objectives. Our decision does not reflect a lack of confidence in the economy. Well, let's put that in plain English. Plain English, things look to be getting better, but we are still cautious. My interpretation was what was interesting of the members voting, you know, there's a lot of members, and only a certain amount of them vote. Three members dissented and voted for an increase in the federal funds rate. The rest voted for a hold. This was the largest split vote in years. Interesting. Then for indication of future direction in rates, experts also reviewed the so-called dot plot. That is published after each Fed meeting. This is a graph, and it shows the projections of all the members, the voting members and the ones that don't vote, 16 of them, of the so-called Federal Open Market Committee. They put a dot on where they think interest rates may be in the future, all 16 of them. We call that the dot plot. Market participants look at this graph to arrive at some sort of opinion as to what the Feds may do at subsequent policy meetings. Currently, the members' average expectation is for rates to hit 1.27 at the end of 2015, which never did, 2.68 at the end of this year, 3.54 in 2017, and 3.79% in the long run. Wouldn't you like to get 3.79% on your savings account? Yeah, not today. The current target for the Fed's fund rate today is 0.25%, quarter of a percent, to zero, which is a long way from the dot plot viewed after last week's federal meeting. Keep in mind, the Federal Reserve is data dependent, and they can, and have changed their view repeatedly as economic measurements trickle in. No matter what the Feds do at their next rate-setting meeting in December, my birthday month, fixed-income investors and retirees living on savings no doubt were not thrilled with no increase yet again. If the Feds decide to start a consistent pattern of rate increases in accordance with the dot plot, you investors out there counting on interest income to pay your bills and may have money in a savings account could finally start to see some hope in an otherwise dismal interest rate environment. What do you think about that? Could we see a federal funds rate increase? Finally make some money on savings accounts? We'll see. My name's Mark. Be right back.
Animals on my feet, pretty rocks on my feet.
And you're tuned to Money Matters on Community Radio Station. My name's Mark. Thanks for joining me today on your economic forum. So, yeah, the Federal Reserve, they held firm on interest rates. Many Americans do not fully comprehend exactly it is what the Federal Reserve actually does, commonly referred to as the Fed. From their website, the Federal Reserve, their function can be summed up as conducting the nation's monetary policy, supervising and regulating banks and other important financial institutions, maintaining the stability of the financial system, providing certain financial services to the U.S. government, U.S. financial institutions, and foreign official institutions. The Fed has three key entities, the 12 regional banks. Those are 12 districts that cover the U.S. and are the operating arms of the Fed. The Federal Reserve Governor is the governing body that reports to the government, to Congress, and the Federal Open Market Committee, which is responsible for what is called open market operations.
Huh?
What are those? Open market operations refer to the buying and selling of government securities in the open market in order to expand or contract the amount of money in the banking system. Expand or contract the amount of money in the banking system. It all sounds a bit technical, but think of it as a gas pedal for the economy, or at least one of the gas pedals possessed by the Fed. Press on the gas pedal and away you go. Lift off the gas pedal and things slow down. So how do these open market operations act like a throttle on an economy, allowing it to speed up, which is improve economic conditions, or slow down, which is to cool off an overheating economy from inflation? It all has to do with how inflation works. Simply put, increase the amount of money in an economy, conditions generally improve, and prices tend to rise, which we know as inflation. If we withdraw or reduce the amount of money in the system, the economy supposedly slows, and prices tend to fall, deflation. The open market operations play to this mechanism. In one instance, the Feds print up some money and buy debt that large U.S. banks are required to hold, which are called bank reserves. So these big banks hold money called bank reserves. They're required to hold those. This debt, it's not really money, but it's debt, include U.S. treasuries, which are government IOUs, or debt from Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, which is basically government-backed mortgages. Large banks always hold vast amounts of these types of IOUs, and a part of this operation, they agree to let the Feds buy or sell these IOUs at any time as part of the OMO program. When buying these from the banks, they go to the banks, they say, okay, we want to buy some of your IOUs. We want to buy some treasuries. We want to buy some of these mortgages. The Feds give the banks money in exchange. The Feds can also do the reverse and order the banks to buy the IOUs back from the Fed. So when the Fed buys IOUs from the banks, the Fed gives the banks money. That increases the money in the system. When the Feds order the banks to do the reverse and buy IOUs from the Fed, the banks must give the Fed money, taking money out of the system. This back and forth selling or buying between the banks and the Federal Reserve either funnels more cash into the banking system when the Feds buy the debt from the banks and give the banks money, or it takes money out of the system when the Feds order the banks to buy the IOUs from them. Incidentally, the banks make a profit every time a transaction takes place because the Feds pay them a little bit extra when they are on the buy side of the equation. A buy and sell of the same IOU can happen overnight, meaning the Feds sell the IOU one day, then they buy it back the next. These are called repos, or overnight repurchase agreements. The repurchase agreements can also be much longer in duration. They don't have to buy them back the next day. They can buy them back in a week or a month. When the Feds buy the IOUs from the bank, they give the banks money. More money goes into the banking system, and the gas pedal is pressed down. When the Feds order the banks to buy IOUs from them, money is taken out of the system as the banks give the Fed money and the pedal is lifted, slowing things down. By adding or subtracting money from the banking system, the Feds hope to control how much money is lent out to consumers and businesses, thereby stimulating or slowing the economy. Money is the fuel which drives the economy, and by simply adding or subtracting it, they stimulate or slow the economy. Coupled with a variety of other tools at the Fed's disposal, they hope to control the economy in the direction they want it to go and at the instant they want it to go there. Of course, given the history of the market crashes, economic blow-ups, and the severity of such events since the Fed's inception in 1913, I will leave it to you to decide whether they actually accomplish this task. You're listening to Money Matters on your community radio station. My name's Mark. I'll be right back. Money Matters on your community radio station. My name's Mark. Thanks for joining me today. Out from the Safe Money Report, Census Bureau reported that spending on new cars tanked 4.5% in August. That's the biggest monthly drop since September of 2014. Meanwhile, J.D. Power said incentives hit an all-time high, $3,923 per vehicle in September. Previous record was set in December 2008 when the economy was mired in the Great Recession and one of our auto companies was tumbling toward bankruptcy and a massive government bailout. Safe Money Report goes out to say, as for real estate, pending sales of existing homes dropped 2.4% in August. That left them at their lowest level since January. New home sales plunged 7.6%. Ouch. While inventory on the market jumped. As housing starts skidded 5.8% with both single-family home and multifamily construction dropping sharply. Whoa. He's also gone on to say that, something we're going to cover in just a second. Safe Money Report again, just how sick are Europeans' banks and why should we care? Mike Larson, Safe Money Report. Just over a decade ago, the housing and mortgage markets began to melt down here in the U.S., the resulting credit and economic crisis caused Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers to collapse, pushing the U.S. economy into the deepest downturn since the Great Depression, and prompted the biggest Fed and Treasury bailout of the banking system ever. Well, we all know that, right? It's when the banking system was about to melt down. But But if there was an upside to the whole mess, it's that this U.S. banking system was force-fed capital. These institutions that survived the banking purge came out on the other side in much better fundamental shape than when they went in, so says Mike Larson. That didn't happen in Europe, though, he says. We exported the crisis there. And European markets and banks tumbled. But regulators did not infuse them with enough capital around the time of the crisis and allowed balance sheet problems to foster long after the crisis ended. Throw in the pigs country meltdown a few years ago and the toxic impact of NERP and ZERP, near zero interest rates and zero interest rates. Those impacts on bank profitability, and you get the total mess European banks may be in today. He goes on to say, Deutsche Bank. So we are seeing some stress in the banking sectors. But more importantly, we're seeing banking stress at Deutsche. Now, Deutsche Bank is a German banking conglomerate. It has seen better days. Its stock cut in thirds in the last 2 years. Investors have hammered the shares under swirling rumors and concerns about its financial health and long-term viability. Deutsche Bank is no small potatoes, ladies and gentlemen. It has more than 100,000 employees in over 7 countries. That's one big bank. Over 70 countries, excuse me. Has a large presence in Europe, the Americas, Asia Pacific, and the emerging markets. 2009, Deutsche Bank was the largest foreign exchange dealer in the world with a market share of 21%. The trouble started during the banking blow-up for Deutsche and housing crash, says Wikipedia. Deutsche Bank was one of the major drivers of the collateralized debt obligation, the CDO. That was the market that had big trouble during the housing credit bubble from 08 onward. There was $32 trillion created in collateralized debt obligations. The 2001 U.S. Senate Permanent Select Committee on Investigations report on Wall Street and financial crisis analyzed Deutsche Bank as a case study of investment banking involvement in the mortgage bubble. Then, when the majority of large banks were retrenching after the crisis and shoring up their balance sheets, Deutsche bet the markets would loosen, and they increased their leverage. This bet apparently failed as markets remained anemic and the bank regulations tightened on Deutsche and other banks. Just because it's a German bank, however, don't think your taxpayer dollars weren't used to shore up Deutsche. In 2008, Deutsche Bank reported its first annual loss in 5 decades and received somewhere in the neighborhood of $11.8 billion from U.S. taxpayers when they bailed out AIG, the American insurance company Deutsche had dealings with. Fast forward 7 years later to today, and Deutsche is still apparently in trouble, and it appears to be getting worse. Its troubles are not its own, however. With a reported $70 trillion in derivatives on its books, $70 trillion worth of derivatives on its books. Derivatives are large unregulated bets of which content and trigger points are known only to Deutsche. If Deutsche collapses, if it happens indeed, it would have, some say, a much greater impact on financial markets than the Lehman Brothers fiasco that many argue was the first domino in the banking blow-up that almost melted global financial markets in 08 and 09. Mr. Jim Willey, who we have interviewed on this show, in his Silver Doctor's September 17th essay said, "The important thing to keep in mind about Deutsche Bank is that it won't go down alone if it goes down at all. If it fails," says Mr. Willey, "it will take along 3, 4, 5, 6, or 10, or even 15 other banks with it." TheStreet.com added to the specter of a Deutsche failure when it wrote on August 25th, "The 2008 and 2009 global financial crisis is nothing compared to what would happen if Deutsche Bank, a keystone of the global financial system, collapsed." Is the failure of Deutsche plausible? Well, in my opinion, it's hard to imagine that they would let Deutsche fail, given the recent history of central bank intervention when it comes to too big to fail banks. Right? I mean, we've bailed out much smaller institutions before. Just look at the Federal Reserve's own release on where the money went. Where'd the money go? Can the Global Monetary Authorities let Deutsche go, given the possible ramifications of such a failure? My money is on another bailout. Your money might be in it as well. Should Deutsche be forced to ask for a life preserver? The ironic part here is that this bank, the people who run it, and authorities that regulate it, apparently didn't learn much from the 08 and 09 crisis that occurred just a few short years ago, right? How many years ago was that? Eight? Once again, the taxpayers of the world will likely pay the price, resulting from the actions of others who are looking to line their pockets with obscene amounts of money. We'll be right back. You're listening to Money Matters on your community radio station. Tune to Money Matters on your community radio station. Thanks for joining me today. My name's Mark. October 6, 2016, 12:41 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, Year of Our Lord. You may be hearing the show at another time. It is picked up by other stations and rebroadcast. A lot of times I don't know when they rebroadcast. It could be day, 3 days later. I don't know. What the heck do I know? But welcome. You can always send an email to the program director at whatever station you're hearing the show on. and let them know what you think of the show. Maybe give me some topics on what you might want to talk about, and tell me you like the show or hate the show or whatever. You know, that's why I'm here, to help spread the news. Coal. As you know, this is an economic show. We talk about money. And instructed to stay away from politics. So, I used to do a morning show. I did politics. So, I got a lot of hate mail. I got a lot of good mail, but I got a lot of hate mail. You know, it's two sides of the aisle here. So, I don't do politics anymore. Station said, you can do a money show, but you can't do politics. I said, good. I don't want to do politics. I get yelled at when I do politics. But we do money. And I try not to interject my morals into the show. For instance, I might say tobacco stocks have a history of gracious dividends. Right? They may or may not. I have to say that due to federal regulations that I cannot say. They always pay dividends. Dividends are always up in the air. But let's say I just talked about tobacco stocks. That doesn't mean that I own them. And I'm not telling you to own them. Okay? I'm just stating a fact. So there are a lot of industries that I do not own because of my morals. But my job is not to inflict my morals on you. Okay? I just tell you information. So that is what precedes this piece, coal. Okay? I'm not saying coal is a good thing. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying coal. C-O-L-E. No, it's C-O-A-L. Coal, black as night but bleeding red. That's the story for energy investors that held coal and coal stocks at the start of this year, and indeed the last few years. At the start of 2016, coal prices languished and were near decade lows because of waning demand from utilities, which were seeking to curb pollution, and also amid the International Energy Agency's declaration that the fuel's golden age, at least in China, was over. Pressure from U.S. authorities and green supporters did not help the coal story. Out of favor and hated, coal and the companies that produced it saw prices continually erode with seemingly no let-up. Just Google up the price of coal. A lot of their companies. From the website TradingEconomics.com, coal reached an all-time high of $139.05 in January of 2011 and a record low of $48.80 in January of 2016. So that was almost cut in thirds. Not quite. But like a phoenix rising from the ashes, coal did not die completely, as some had thought and others had hoped. The old investment theory of buy when there's blood in the streets had apparently been exercised, at least by some traders in recent months, as coal has made a rather startling comeback. Prices are set to record their first annual rise since 2010, should the increase trend continue. It's a commodity that's been on a slippery slide for the past 4 years, and it's making a remarkable recovery, said Eric Stavseth, an analyst at Arctic Securities in Oslo, who tracks the coal market and has for almost a decade. The possibility of extreme weather from a two-year La Nina event, which may hit major producers in the upcoming winter, could cause production problems. If we recall, back in 2010 and 2011 in Australia and Indonesia, severe rains flooded mines there. Flooded the mines of the world's two largest exporters. Some fear the same could happen this year. China is further boosting imports of its coal. That's another factor that could push prices even higher. However, as in investing, there are always cross currents, theories, things flowing back and forth. And, as always, when it comes to investing prognostications, they can be wrong as many times as they can be right. Coal's competing energy source, crude oil, is not at a decade low, but near it, with some projecting oil to go lower. If oil does drop further in price, it will put pressure on the prices of all energy sources. Additionally, the public's impression of coal really hasn't improved much, and is not likely to do so as the discussion over global warming is ongoing. The continuing interest in alternative energy is also not likely to go away anytime soon. These and other factors could weigh negatively on coal demand and subsequently its price, offsetting speculators that might be betting on the current uptrend. Regardless of where one stands on the issue of coal and its use as an energy source, its recent resurgence, at least in price, is an interesting event, and it could point to the possibility that coal's darkest days are behind it. You're listening to Money Matters. My name is Mark Cuniberti. Thanks for joining me today. And finally, we get a lot of questions on bonds. I keep getting those questions. I try to explain bonds, and people say, well, what is a bond? And so I have to keep explaining what a bond is. And I must not be doing a good job because people keep asking me. So here we go again. Bonds, people have heard the name. Don't know what it is. You're a bail bond. But a bond is an IOU. That's all it is. It's an IOU. The financial industry, in my opinion, likes to keep people guessing as to these terms. So they keep coming back to the financial industry. But bonds are IOUs. You loan someone your money, and in return, you get an IOU. That's the bond. Simple. Now you know. These IOUs or bonds have infinite possibilities as to the terms, which states what you get back, how much money you get back, when you get it back, if there's collateral, the interest rate you may get, and just about anything else the two people agree on. The most common bonds, of course, are issued by sovereign governments, states, municipalities, and corporations. Bonds can be insured or not insured. The question on an insured bond is to ask, who is insuring it, right? Because if you get somebody that insures a bond that's not very financially strong, maybe they can't pay the insurance if the bond fails. Unlike stocks, bonds are what I call a linear investment, where stocks can rise or fall because there's no face value printed on a stock certificate, at least a public standard stock certificate. Investors can lose money based on the movement of the stock in the stock market, or you can make money. However, bonds, as a general rule, have a face value printed on them. Usually it's $1,000, but $1,000 bond always states $1,000. Doesn't change like a $20 bill. If an investor sells a bond before its maturity date, let's say you buy a 10-year bond, it's due in 10 years. If you sell it before it matures, the price you get for it can fall or rise. That depends on interest rates. That's a little more tricky to understand, explain. But if you sell a bond before it matures, you could get the same amount, less amount, or more. If an investor keeps the bond until it matures, the value, face value on the bond is paid. $1,000 bond comes mature, you get $1,000. Any interest you might make by lending the money, also known as the coupon rate, can be paid throughout the bond's life, like yearly, or can it be paid all at once when the bond is paid off? In other words, you get yearly payments on your interest, or you don't get any interest till the very end. You get all the interest at the end. That can be called a zero coupon bond. I call bonds linear investments because the face value printed on the bond remains the same. And if the bond is held to maturity, the value does not change, unlike a stock price, which can change daily. Stocks have no face value printed on them, unlike a bond, which does. The end result from owning a bond is you either get paid or you don't get paid, which is why I call them linear. Its value is a straight line. It's $1,000. That's assuming you get paid. An issuer of a bond that can't pay is said to be in default, and an investor can lose his money. The reason for default would likely be lack of funds. The borrower simply does not have the money to pay. If the bond goes into default, many things can happen, most of them bad, to the person who lent the money out and holds the bond. The issuer, person who owes the money, can offer to renegotiate the bond. It can say, I'll pay you not all of it, but only some of it. Partially pay what it owes, whereby the investor gets only some of his money back. Or the bond can be rolled over, which means the maturity date is redrawn to a later date and they issue a new bond. And perhaps even new terms and conditions. I can't pay, so I'm going to give you another IOU, give me another 10 years to pay. A flat-out default means the investor gets nothing. If the bond is insured, the insurer, whoever that would be on the hook for the payment. If not, the investor might have to seek relief by way of the judicial system, sue, or might wait in line if the borrower declares bankruptcy, which on a defaulting bond issuer is possible, right? Can't pay, I owe too many, I'm going to go into bankruptcy. If a bond issuer cannot renegotiate with all its bondholders, it has no money, it won't have any choice. Bonds are commonly referred to as a fixed income investment. Okay, so somebody says, I got a fixed income investment, it could be a bond. They're called that because their yields can be somewhat predictable until the terms are broken by the issuer, which means can't pay. Bonds can be a way and are thought to be a way to diversify a portfolio and provide a predictable source of income. As in most investments, of course, bonds do have inherent risks in them. You might not get paid. Investors should read the prospectus and financial sheets of the issuing entity, the bond issuer. Understand completely the terms and conditions of any debt instruments you are considering. And of course, always recommended to consult an investment professional before investing. You're tuned to Money Matters. My name's Mark, and we'll be right back to conclude the show. My name is Mark Cuniverti. Remember, discussions in this show, Money Matters, should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I, Mark, am an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. The views expressed are my opinions only or the opinions of the authors or guests I may have on the show. The opinions may not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, this station, its staff, members, or underwriters. My name's Mark. Thanks for joining me. Don't forget our Turkey Matters, where we're matching a portion of your funds to your local food banks. MoneyManagementRadio.com has that information on it. And you can get a newsletter there if you like. Agrata, our way of saying thank you for listening to your community radio station. God bless.
get back. I'm all right, Jack. Keep your hands off of my stack. Money, it's a hit. Don't.